It is always nicer in your words rather than mine. Do you mind just introducing yourself?
Yes, my name is Les Hinton. I am formerly the chief of a large part of Rupert Murdoch's media empire, and I've now just written a book.
And it is your autobiography, your memoirs. Why is this the right time to do that? I mean, for a newsman to look backwards rather than forwards.
Right, and also to write quite a long time after I left the company. And the reason was that I had worked for Rupert Murdoch for 52 years, and he would be among the most vilified public figures, certainly in the media world. And I'd worked for him for so long, and also saw his flaws, but struggled to work out how I could write a book that would be a properly, at least my version of the truth about him, that wouldn't be tainted by any kind of sense of excessive loyalty, that I could look at him coldly and decide for myself and express it in a way that I hope people would believe was a true image of him, because he, for all his flaws, has achieved a great deal. But also in the course of those achievements, he's made a number of enemies, and to be honest, he's deserved some of them.
What's your part in this? Because right off the bat, you're defining yourself by Murdoch.
Well, no, I was reacting to the question and the context about the delay in writing it, and in writing the book, in fact, it is he obviously is a leading character in it, but I've written the book from the very start of my life in wartime Bootle, which was the after London the most blitzed part of the country, and in ruins at the time of my birth, which is a little bit before D-Day, and it's really the progress from there that I thought made the story interesting. I call the book The Bootle Boy, which is where I was born, and also An Untidy Life in News, because I travelled so much over so many years, both with my father, who was an army sergeant, and then hitching myself to Rupert Murdoch's wagon train as an adult. And so he played a very important part in it. And of course, the importance of that part grew as I reached my 30s and 40s and began to do important jobs working closely with him. But I met him at first in Adelaide when I was a kid, 15 years old.
Well, let's kick off with that. So you started at the News, the sort of the evening tabloid of Adelaide at the time. Mm. Tell me about, you know, walking into your first newsroom and taking that job.
Well, I had always wanted to be a journalist from the age of about 11 or 12, and I read the great British newspapers when they were really huge. My handicap was, having been to 13 schools in 10 years, that I'd done nothing but I went to a secondary modern school. So I failed my 11 plus. And I had essentially no education except some proficiency recognised by the schools in English. So I wanted to be a journalist. I'd read the newspapers. I mean, I didn't come from the posh side of newspapers. We had the Daily Mirror and the Daily Mail. But I loved the writing in it, and I loved the excitement of them. And so I went, when my father eventually finished in the army, my sister had married an Australian soldier, and we moved to Adelaide. A little country town, almost a beautiful place, but small. And I walked into the local evening paper. And
what kind of year was this?
This was 1959. It was, and I was 15 years and 3 months old. And the editor there was a very eminent journalist called Rowan Rivette. And he interviewed me. I got to be interviewed by the editor in chief, which is fairly unusual. And for reasons I can never understand, really, because I didn't know anything about Australia except that Dob Bradman could hit cricket balls, and he just gave me a job, and I arrived there, and suddenly I'm sitting in this great newsroom, all the noise, all the frantic, frightening blue haze and chaos and the roaring presses, and it was just fantastic.
What were the people like, the characters?
Well, there were many of them. And the thing about journalists, everyone has this idea of what journalists are like, but the truth is you can't really categorise them. They're teetotalers, or they're complete drinkers, boozers. They're quiet, or they're incredibly angry. But in the end, they do a fantastic job. And there's a kind of anarchic quality to newspapers. Like, first, I'm sure the divorce rate among journalists is pretty high because they live wild lives. So they were really my first faculty, because I didn't have any proper education, and sitting with these guys, going to the pub with them, and listening to their stories, it was like being in a seminar, and the tuition fee was a round of drinks. And I learned a huge amount from them, listening to them, and they were frightening sometimes, because the notion of HR and the proper treatment of employees and the awfulness of bullying, all great things that exist now. Well, in those days, it was pretty wild.
Was there any advice then, I suppose, from those days that's still relevant to a budding journalist 60 years later?
Well, it's such a different world, because when people, I'm often asked, well, would you recommend a 21-year-old now to go into journalism?
And or a 15-year-old.
Or a 15-year-old. Well, 15-year-olds don't normally find themselves in that position. But and the answer is, for all the change in circumstances, that it is still a wonderful business, because you can talk about newspapers, and the fact is that print newspapers are, to say the least, struggling. But the business of telling stories existed over campfires hundreds and thousands of years ago, and long before printing presses, and the business of telling stories will exist long beyond. So the truth is that if you're interested in it and you enjoy it, and it means meeting people, it means traveling, it means writing, it does not mean getting rich. I mean, I was lucky to go into management, to high-level management. You can live a very comfortable life financially, but it's more than that, and it's what I really want. That's all I ever wanted to do, never expecting to become rich. It is extraordinarily rewarding way to live.
As you mentioned earlier, your working life was, throughout the whole of your career, tied up with Rupert Murdoch and his growing news empire. I mean, I know you've probably been asked this question by every interviewer, but I mean, tell me about working alongside that closely to such a man who's, I suppose, defined the modern era.
Well, to give you an idea of the range of my experience with him, I was at the age of 15 in the editor's office fixing the newspaper files, which is what you had to do in those days, pile them up neatly so he can read them. And the editor came into my office and said, "This is a day that you'll remember for the rest of your life." He said, "It is the day that Rupert Murdoch left Little Adelaide and bought a newspaper outside. He bought a newspaper in Sydney." He said, "And it's going to be one of many." I mean, neither Rowan Rivette, the editor, or certainly me, I was just a kid, or Rupert could have imagined the scale of understatement when he said that. In fact, the word "news" from the Adelaide News was the name of the company, and still is name of a big chunk of it, for years and years to come.
And then, obviously,
I got to know him gradually. I mean, for the first encounter I had with him physically was when I was hiding in his office watching his television set, and he came in. And I was hiding behind the big leather settee. I don't know why he never locked his office, but he didn't. And we would go down there because it was the only television in the building in those days, which was, again, 1959. And he came in when I was sitting behind this settee watching, I don't know, Bonanza or something, some ancient TV show. And he came in, and I was sure that this was the end of my days in the newspaper business. And I sat there for what felt like 5 years, but was essentially about 90 seconds before he turned off the TV and left and never saw me. And years later, when I confessed to him, he laughed, of course, a lot, but didn't dispute that he would have fired me on the spot if he'd fired me. And then I ended up buying his sandwiches and then becoming a cadet reporter. And after that, when I was in London, I worked for his newspapers here, The Sun in particular, and gradually from The Sun was sent to the New York office, which was my great... I mean, I did lots of work as a reporter in Ireland and Cyprus and difficult places. But then I got the plum job of all, which was to be the New York correspondent. And from then, that was when he was beginning his whole empire in America. There was nothing there. We were on two floors in New York City. And he had no magazines, he had no television, he had no films, he had nothing. And as he grew, and I'd become acquainted with him, and I was doing various things on an editorial level, I guess I was just sucked into the growth and the need for people he could have around him who he knew and could trust, because it was a strange place. Rupert loved to be the underdog wherever he went, and he was an underdog there yet again, having done it in Sydney and having done it in London. And so then it grew, and I just, as the company grew, I found myself going to more and more places, doing more and more responsible jobs.
Your career with him lasted until 2011, when you resigned over the phone hacking scandal at the News of the World. I mean, tell me about that.
Well, what happened was I had been at News International as executive chairman until 2007, during which time Clive Goodman and a private investigator were both found, well, admitted having hacked phones and went to prison briefly. I then went to America because Rupert had bought a huge operation, Dow Jones, the Wall Street Journal, very big. And I was buried in that for 3.5 years. But then it all blew up in connection with the hacking of the phone of Millie Dowler, a girl who'd been kidnapped and was, in fact, murdered, as everybody knows. that created a kind of firestorm, and everyone jumped in. There were lots of people that didn't like. I mean, first of all, talking about this always makes it. It's always important for me to say that I recognize how bad, how wrong this was, and it was the stupid. It damaged people's lives and everything else. But what also happened was, because Rupert had so many enemies he'd made over the years, as we were saying, and in particular at this stage, not always with Labour, but Labour disliked him intensely. They piled in, and basically the sort of enemies got through his gates. And it was on my watch that this happened. I didn't know about it. I've been interrogated for hours by all kinds of law enforcement people, and I didn't know about it. And I think that's generally accepted.
But you have known about it?
Well, but it did happen on my watch. And therefore, in the old time-honored cliche of a resignation letter, it happened on my watch and I left. Now, that's an unanswerable question, which I'm asked a lot. To give some perspective, the News of the World was a very important entity of what I was managing. But there were also three other huge national newspapers. I was trying to struggle to get into the digital age. We had magazines, we had Times Literary Supplement, Times Education Supplement. We had radio stations in Holland and in Germany and in Scandinavia. All of this we were building. There was a lot on my plate, and I didn't know. And it's a bit like, I don't know, if you're the manager of Selfridges and you go down to the jewelry department and somebody, you go and say, hey, anyone done any shoplifting lately? Talking to the employees, and they would say, well, no, sir. And they're not going to tell me. I mean, it's interesting that, I mean, I've run big companies for a long time, and there have been occasions. There was one particular occasion in America where someone was found embezzling money, and they were arrested and they were imprisoned, and no one cared. But it's the sensitivity of something like this being part of the media made a big difference in the sort of scandal it caused.
And it is a more emotive subject. It's affecting people's lives in a way that embezzling is a bit more cold.
I'm just talking about the knowledge, the difficulty of knowing when you've got, I mean, I had between 6,000 and 7,000 employees working in all over Britain, Ireland, Holland. So there were a lot of things going on.
Do you think then, based on what you were saying about the enemies that Murdoch had at that time, that you were effectively a senior scapegoat then, a firewall for him?
Well, I mean, you could express it like that, but that's not... I mean, there were a few people in the company, not sure who, that sort of briefed against me, but I'd offered my resignation to Rupert because when the News of the World was closed, which I was surprised that they decided to do, I offered to resign, and Rupert, not then, but eventually, as the air caught fire, he accepted the resignation, and I didn't have a choice, you know.
Continuing with America, obviously you were there as the CEO of Dow Jones at that point when it was taken over. In many ways, that has hugely taken off for Rupert Murdoch, the news international empire, and Fox in particular. Now, effectively, with the influence that it seems to have over the White House and the Trump presidency, it could be argued the most powerful news influence in the world. I mean, what do you make of that?
So, I mean, you're talking about Fox News and its support for Donald Trump. It stands out among the other news operations, let's say news channels, but there are newspapers as well from others, in being fairly lonely in that position. It's also the most successful, most viewed of all of them. The others, one of the difficulties in America now is that you actually can't sit down like you can here and watch a balanced news program, because it's either frenetically pro-Trump, which Fox is, or incredibly critical of him, which CNN say is. There are others, but you get the point. I my own sentiments are, I mean, I am an American citizen as well as a British one, and I think that Trump is the most dreadful senior politician that I've ever been associated as a voter with the election of. So I don't share the Fox enthusiasm for it, but it's there. And Fox was born out of its creation was based on the feeling that most of the big news outlets in America were leftish and liberalish and East Coast, West Coast, and that there was a neglected heartland of more conservative thinking. And I wasn't involved in this, by the way. The channel was created to connect with those people, and it became hugely successful. So, you know, it's easy if you disagree with it to deplore it. I disagree with it, and I think they go over the top periodically, but they're entitled to do it, you know, and people like it. So what do you say?
But I would say that over the last few years, the business of news has been tainted by the call of fake news, Trump's favourite expression. Not just Fox, but the way that American media has developed, partly in response to what Murdoch's media empire has done. I mean, do you see any connection there?
So I think, well, not really, but I think that fake news is a great sort of buzzword that he's employed, and it has to be said that almost all the time he employs it, he's referring to something that turns out to be true. So he is a classic demagogic propagandist. And what's the most disturbing thing is this knowledge of this idea of fake news has been picked up by people. American presidents, whatever you think, don't have nearly so much power as everyone imagined. They call the most powerful person in the world, and they are, because I guess they're the commander in chief and they can wage war pretty well. They've got to get some better. But the Congress and the Senate really, and the Supreme Court in America, are really, really powerful and balance this power against the administration, which is Trump. So he's not that powerful. But one thing that's interesting is his power. He's an incredibly good rabble rouser, to put it crudely. And you can now see people with real demagogic power, despots in South America, in the Philippines, all employing fake news as the mantra to justify taking real action against the press, the media. And he can't do that because even more than this country, the media is protected against government interference in a way that probably no other country in the world is.
But the influence and the connections between the Murdoch and the Trump households, there isn't a sense to which the Trump presidency is born out of the Murdoch's empire.
Initially, when he started to run for president, Rupert was on Twitter before he was well advised to stop being on Twitter. And he was very critical of Trump. So he was never a great admirer of Trump. I think, though, that the thing about him and Trump is that you can look at his personality and the fact that he's basically a weirdo, but you can also look at things he's done in terms of regulation, whether you agree or not. There's a lot of support among the conservative movement, regulation, taxation. So there are things he's done or allowed to be done. I don't think he's particularly got great ideology at all, Trump. I think he's just a pragmatist. But a lot has been done that people of the right and so that's where he's getting his support. And even though he appears on the face of it to be in quite serious trouble with what he may or may not have done wrong, it's surprising the extent to which opinion polls across the country, of the people that voted for him, there was a poll, and it's interesting this, if it's accurate, but there's a poll done of those people who voted for him. And the last time I looked at it, I think 91% of the people who voted for him said they'd vote for him again. So it's very interesting because the vocal cords of America, if you accept Fox News, are inclined to be in the hands of his antagonists. And I share broadly, I share the view of the antagonists. But it can misrepresent what's going on below the surface in the heartland of the country.
And if you were still with the company, would you have done things differently over the last 7 years?
Well, no, I was never. I mean, I ran television for Rupert, but long before the real Fox News was launched.
Oh, but even in terms of the Wall Street Journal,
yeah.
Dow Jones.
Yeah, but the Wall Street Journal, which is, you know, among the. And I don't think anyone would dispute this. I'm bound to say, but I wouldn't dispute it. You put the New York Times, which is the principal foe, really, of the Wall Street Journal. You put those two papers together. Maybe the Washington Post as well. Not sure. The London Times. These are the great newspapers in the English language world. And for all the issues of how Rupert or Fox News has manifested its views of the Wall Street Journal's news pages are in fact quite separate from its opinion pages, and its opinion pages are often very critical of Trump, but often when he does particular policy things they like, is very supportive of him. So the journal is as it was when I left and I was its publisher. It's down the middle in its news. It's very conservative in its news pages. And again, I didn't always agree with the news pages, but I often did also. So I don't think things would have been much different if I'd continued to do the job I was doing when I left.
But I've spoken to Wall Street Journal journalists since the election of Trump who suggest that there is effectively a ban on them speaking about the Trump presidency outside of the newsroom. It feels like, you know, there is a an interest from editorial in what their journalists say about it.
That's true, partly, and I think there is sensitivity because there's so much sensitivity about being, because the journalists at the Journal are very principled people, brilliant people by and large, and they're very, very sensitive to being caught in the umbrella of the sort of position that Fox News takes. But if you were to compare, if you spent a week in New York and you were to look at the New York Times news pages and the Journal news pages, there's no doubt in my mind that when you looked at any evidence of bias, you'd see how antagonistic the New York Times is, far more than you could see any unreasonable sort of support or approval of what Trump has done.
Taking a step back then, looking at your role in News UK, News International, how has it changed the world?
Well, let's look at the positive side. So surprisingly, I like to do that. But if you were to take this country alone and look at Rupert Murdoch's part in the last half century and what his contribution has been, there are two things that he did that will change the face of the country in lots of ways. First of all, in the late 80s, this country was the, so far as media was concerned, TV in particular, was really totally beholden to a sort of snug duopoly of the BBC and ITV. He risked the entire company and came close to costing him the entire company to get Sky off the ground. And Sky has created an abundance of choice that was just far better. From the point of view of the regular viewer in this country, there is far more. And as that's happened, other things have opened up, cables opened up. But it was his wedge that created that abundance of. And that has to be good for the variety of entertainment and opinion in the country. You can listen to Al Jazeera or whatever on Fox. You can get every type of view you want. And on the other hand, in the mid-80s, when newspapers were still major, well, they still are, but where they were really, really, and they were being held hostage by unions. And for years and years, the management of the big newspaper groups had been too timid to confront them. He confronted them with great, in a very controversial situation. And all the other newspapers, all the other executives of other newspapers, they stood back with their arms folded while he went through real hell before the unions finally succumbed. And upon that happening, they all quickly adopted the cost-saving modern techniques that he made it possible for them, thereby giving them much greater life, many more pages, much better for readers. And I think for all its struggling now, the difficulties of the newspaper business would have been much more serious much sooner, and that Fleet Street was where everyone dwelt. And I think Fleet Street would have been the newspaper industry's tomb if it hadn't been for what he did. So, and those two are quite important things. I think the Times has been good. I think the Sun has been a great newspaper over the years. I mean, it's been very popular. It was irreverent. It drove the conversation. You literally turn on the Today Show on the BBC, and what it was leading with in the days when I was there. So I think although he's not a flawless human being, that he's made a huge contribution, and he's done this. He did the same thing in America, but this is going to be more interesting.
What about the counter to that? I mean, are there any regrets?
No, I think that the damage of the phone hacking thing, although it was very serious, in the end, I think 8 people were found guilty of doing it. I mean, it was serious, and the compounding effect that had, and the way people jumped on it and jumped on news, even though, as it transpired, the Daily Mirror Group would appear to have been doing it. I mean, one of the lawyers in court said the other day that what the News of the World did makes it looks like a country picnic compared to what the Mirror Group newspapers were doing. But of course, Labour, since the Mirror are the only newspaper group that reliably supports them, they're surprisingly muted. But still, that was a bad experience. The Whopping battle caused a lot of. He took a lot of flack for that, but in the end, you have to just look at the result. You don't. It's that old cliche about omelets and eggs, you know. I mean, he has achieved a lot, but he can be a cussed, difficult guy, and I experienced that.
You say he was a cussed man to work past. You've said some of the stories of battles, but what about your personal battles with him? Was there anything that you particularly butted heads over?
No, I mean, the key, it's interesting because he's very, very powerful. And as he grew more famous, people would be sort of terrified of him. And so if ever we had a lunch and he'd always want to meet young, new, bright young, I had to sit down and say to them, look, if you keep quiet, just sit there. I'm never going to let you into one of these lunches again. Otherwise, they'd just sit there terrified. You can imagine. And they sit there. And I'd known him for so long and seen him that he made me tense for sure, but I was never actually afraid of him. And I knew that unless I made sure he understood my point of view, and I would argue with him, and I would say, look, my job is to make sure you understand what I think. I will, you know, unless he did ask me to do something ridiculous, which he never did, I will do it, but I want to make sure you understand why I think you shouldn't do it. And I think he respected that. He was surprisingly warm to people that were a little cheeky and irreverent to him because he was so sort of surrounded by people that were like in awe of him.
Do you think with that approach he could have got better results if he'd been a little warmer to begin with?
No, I think we mustn't exaggerate the value of being warmth. I mean, you know, some of the great enterprises, newspapers or whatever, are led by brutal bosses, and he could be brutal, but he wasn't actually a brutal person. It's not his personality. When I did something wrong from a business point of view, it's the one time I could be sure he was going to say, look, don't worry, we'll sort it out. He was good like that. If I got too arrogant and smart, then he would sort of smack me. What he did do is that when you worked for him, he did some pretty bold things. I mean, when you look back, trying to start another news television network, or buying the Times, all these things, he really did imbue people who worked for him with a sense of possibility, because he was so bold, and he was clever, but there's loads of clever people. He had two things that are less common among really clever people, was that he was incredibly energetic, worked incredibly hard, and he was very, very bold. He would take chances. And those were really, if you were looking to isolate the qualities of him, clever. You know, I mean, I had loads of Harvard graduates working for me. They were brilliant, but they weren't the same. That astuteness that he had, he was very good at dealing with people, actually. And he could be very sharp, but he could also be very flattering.
Looking to the future, the news empire, Murdoch's empire, is going through interesting times now with potential buyers and splitting and reconsolidating the company.
Yeah.
What do you think to its future direction? And I suppose, do you think that the Murdoch sons, James and Lachlan, will be able to step out of their father's shadow?
Well, I mean, they've been the sort of princes who've thrived under the sponsorship of their dad. There's no doubt about that. And, you know, you could say it was ironic that he is so sceptical about the existence of the monarchy, but was always so determined that his kids should take over. With the way things are changing now, I mean, as you will know, and I guess your listeners will too, to some extent, is that he's disposing of a large chunk of his television production enterprises, also all of Sky. And there are a variety of reasons why he's doing it. I mean, that the landscape of, say, let's take the studios, that's changing rapidly because of the emergence of Hulu and of Netflix and all these others, changing the whole economic climate of it, and I guess he's made the decision that this is the right time to have an even larger company in charge of it. But I don't, I suppose I have to say that I'm surprised. I was surprised he did it, because certainly if it was 20 years ago, it would be like, let's go, guys, and he would be scheming and he's not doing it. His son, James, the younger of his two sons, is by all accounts, and I haven't been told this unimpeachably, but by all accounts is going to break away from the company and start his own enterprise, private equity or whatever. I think that Lachlan, his older son, who's a very wise guy, will end up running the company when his father isn't running it. And I think that from the point of view of print, say, newspapers, which is where I spent a big chunk of my life, I think that it'll be that Lachlan grew up in print, so I think he'll be a very conscientious supporter of print, but he has to do what's right for his shareholders, obviously, and that's going to be difficult. But you know, Rupert surprised people lots of times, and he surprised me by making the sale. But he may have more up his sleeve than I know, because he says hasn't told me.
What do you think then to the future of news in general?
Well, I think I said earlier that the issue of people want to know things. And journalists, and the things they want to know are usually the things that the people who the stories are about don't want to be known. That is the essence of journalism, and the reason it gets into so much difficulty and makes so many enemies. And I think that the need for that, in terms of, use a marketing cliche, consumer demand, is never going to go away. I think what's changing is the distribution of it, because the old newspapers, which are basically, with all their trucks and newsprint and buildings and huge printing presses, all these capital sort of liabilities, they're basically, when you break down the business, they're manufacturing and distribution businesses. And you don't need that degree of manufacturing and distribution and cost in order to disseminate information. But because that's no longer the case, and media is atomized, and the actual job of distributing journalism is much less expensive and more widespread, so it's been diffused. But the need for that, I think, out of all this is going to emerge. I mean, some of the newspapers, we call them newspapers, I think, forever. Just as when you're doing your email and you're invited to CC something, it says that stands for carbon copy. Well, you're actually not making a carbon copy. And when you read the Times online, it's not actually a newspaper. But I think that term will translate. And these great newspapers, I think the heavy newspapers, as we call them in the trade, the higher demo ones like the New York Times, Journal, Times, the Australian in Australia, they'll, I think, survive with paywalls. Their brands will survive. How long their print existence goes on is more problematic, I think. I think they'll go on for quite a long time yet. But they aren't the future in the long term. And journalism and the journalism that they propagate is going to go on forever. But, you know, now, you know, it's terrible for people trying to manage newspaper business in the transition. But from the point of view of you and I as readers, you know, we've got in our pockets and in the palm of our hands infinity. We can read anything, we can watch anything, and that may be creating hell for the people in the business. But for us, it's fantastic. And that's really what we've got to keep a focus on, I think.